I do have a problem with the genitive case when using the name of Jesus. You know what I mean by the genitive case? It's the case of possession. So when you say something belongs to Jesus, so you say, all hail the power of, do you say Jesus's, Jesus or Jesus? Who's a Jesus person? Jesus person. Who's it just says Jesus? Okay. Who's a Jesus's? Just checking. And here's a problem for those names that end with S, the genitive case. Well, I just want to say to you that James was Jesus's, Jesus, Jesus' brother. Okay, the writer of this letter was the brother of Jesus. That's an easier way to say it. Because I have the same problem with James' name, because his name also ends with S, right? This is James's letter. I'll get through it. You can just see me, tell me how many times I get it wrong. This letter is written by James, and he's the brother of Jesus, and he's a leader in the church and a well-respected figure. And we call it a letter, but it starts like a letter, but it doesn't really finish like one. If you look at the end, it just kind of stops. And it's kind of a series of somewhat disconnected pieces of teaching. So lots of commentators think that someone has taken the teaching of this respected figure, James, and they've put it together, this collection of sayings by a first century leader in the church. Now, for a long time, this letter was really dismissed by Protestant churches. So you know we're part of the Protestant church, right? We're Protestants. Now, for a long time, it was dismissed, and really that was because of Martin Luther. So Martin Luther called the book of James an epistle of straw. And the reason for that was it seemed to contradict what Paul had spent so long in saying in the book of Romans or in Ephesians, that salvation is by grace through faith, by grace alone, by faith alone. And here's James saying that faith without deeds is dead, all right? Works is often the word that lots of us have used there instead of deeds. Faith without works or faith without deeds is dead. Martin Luther said that it contradicted Paul and his salvation by grace, and so lots of people ignored it. So what is James talking about here? And that will help give us a clue to how we understand this. What James is talking about, these deeds or works, that's the word, is works. Really, he's talking about practical help for those in need. That's it. He's talking about practical help for those in need. So in chapter 1, he's already said, if you've read the whole letter, that religion that is pure and faultless is to look after widows and orphans and to stay pure from the world. Nevertheless, there's kind of three problems that we have to grapple with, or I had to grapple with, in this piece of scripture. One of the problems is if you say that good works or deeds are the proof of faith, that's how I'll show you how you have faith, says James, by your good deeds. Here's the thing. I know lots of atheists who are really kind. That's kind of a problem, isn't it? If deeds are the proof of faith, one of the guys I went with on the Red Shield ride, he was a great guy, raised over $11,000 for the ride. Through all sorts of ways and means, just a fantastic person, genuinely helpful and kind. He was kind to me, helped me on the ride. At one point he said, look, I'm an atheist. You know, I do this because I want to help people. So he's a good man who's an atheist doing good things. What are we to do with that? Well, we would say as Christians that all good things come from God. Right? All good things come from God. So where we see good in people who don't believe, the source of that is still God. So we believe in God's grace, that God's grace is at work in the world and in the work in people's hearts, even if they don't know him. So it is a term we have for this, prevenient grace, that God's grace in people's lives limits the ravages of sin and allows people to love and to do good, even if they don't know him. All good things come from God. So all goodness is the work of God. It's all the gift of grace. So God's grace is at work among all people, allowing them to love and to do good. And that means in some sense that God is present, Christ is present in every person, whether they know him and acknowledge him or not. Now remember when a New Testament lecturer said this in a class I was attending, and it provoked a lot of discussion, let me tell you, that Christ is present in every person. The lecturer did add, although sometimes in a strange and disturbing disguise. So in some way, the God of all creation is at work in all of his creation, right? His creatures, certainly those made in his image. But because generosity and kindness are products of grace, they will also, without question, be seen in people of faith. And this is what James is talking about. You will see genuine love and kindness and compassion in people of faith. Not just lip service, but practical care and compassion. You'll see grace fully alive in the children of God. People who put their trust in God, because that's what it means to have faith. And kindness, practical kindness and compassion can be a very, very powerful thing. A life-changing thing, world-changing thing. So some time ago now, a long time ago really, back in 1995, I went with a band from Hurstville and some other people from the Corps, and we went to Africa. And it was a fairly extraordinary experience. And one of the things that we did in South Africa was that we went to a hospital that the Salvation Army had. And this is, when we say hospital, kind of a medical clinic, orphanage type deal. And it was started by a Salvation Army officer who had seen a need. And the need was this, that AIDS was rife in the community and babies were being born with AIDS and they were being abandoned by their mothers. And she'd found this little baby who had AIDS, born with AIDS, that had been abandoned. And she thought, I must care for this baby. So she did. And she found more and more babies. And eventually the Salvation Army set up this kind of little hospital clinic type thing. And we went there. And it was one of the most powerful and moving experiences of my life to hear this woman quite simply tell her story of she just wanted every child to live in however long their life was, to know love and dignity in their life. Extraordinary, powerful. I think basically everybody was in tears as we watched this. Now this is an act of kindness, practical, helpful kindness. It's not an intellectual pursuit, didn't require a degree, it just required someone who responded to a need. The other thing that problem I have with this passage is it can sometimes seem like that if you don't do good works, if you're not practically kind, that you're going to hell. And who amongst us has had an opportunity to be kind and, you know, just not done it? Actually, because we're tired or busy or whatever, has just done something else and has not chosen to be practically kind. Does that mean my faith is dead and I'm going to hell? Well, we'd say no. Jane's problem here is not that people don't have faith. He's saying that their faith is shallow. If you have a deep faith, it's going to change the way you live. He said it's not just about belief. He said even the demons believe and they shudder, but even demons believe in God. Believing in God is not enough. And so he talked about works. Now we know that Paul, the Apostle Paul, also talked about works. But Paul was really talking about works as a means to salvation. So if you like, Paul was talking about works and deeds before we're saved, pre-conversion. That salvation comes through the grace of God alone, not by anything we do. James is really talking about holiness. He's really talking about post-conversion. He's saying, for you people of faith, after conversion, your living faith must produce good works. Otherwise, what does it mean? He says that good works are the inevitable outcome of a deep and growing faith. It does not mean if you weren't kind once, when you could have been, that you're not a Christian. It's okay. All right? I just want you to relax. But it does mean if you're never kind and never generous and never compassionate, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with your faith, with my faith. The other interesting thing about this, I don't know if it's a problem, you can decide that, is about the language that he uses here. Now, originally in this, I was going to do this sermon as a kind of a reminder about our obligation to help the poor and those in need from Matthew 25. I don't know if you know that passage. It's a well-known passage about the sheep and the goats, that the Son of Man will come and he'll judge, and the sheep on one side and the goats on the other, just in case you want to know we're sheep, not goats, all right? The sheep are the good guys. So, you know, let's be sheep. That was going to be the sermon. The thing is, and this is the where Jesus says, I was hungry and I was thirsty and I was in prison and, you know, you fed me and you visited me and you clothed me. And Jesus says, when you do it to the least of these, my brothers. Now, here's the thing. Brothers in the New Testament is basically a technical term for Christian. So that's what this passage says. James says, I tell you, brothers, and in the NIV they've added and sisters to make it inclusive. I tell you, brothers. He's saying, I'm telling you, fellow Christians, this is the way you should live. And then a little bit later, he says, if you see a brother or sister in need. And what he means is, fellow Christian. That's why I couldn't kind of preach on the Matthew 25 one, because it wasn't really about going out into the world. It's very specifically Jesus commanding care for the persecuted Christians in the first century church. James says here, if you see a brother and sister in need and you just pray for them, offer them a little good advice, in the words of William Booth, that's not enough. He's saying that care and compassion actually starts among God's people. It actually starts by us caring for each other. And that's our first obligation. And I would say first to our families that we're connected to, second to our church family, and then flowing out into the world. See, one of the dangers of this deeds thing is that it can become a means to an end in its own self. I mean, it is possible, I think, to care for those outside more than we do our own family or our own church family. I remember talking to a young girl, well, she's not a young girl, she's a woman in her 40s now, but I remember talking to her some time ago about her dad, and her dad was this kind of guy that he would just drop whatever he was doing and go and help someone, whether it was out in the community or whether it was in the church, just a really, really helpful guy. And I said, yeah, your dad's a great guy, just willing to help anybody. And she said, well, to be honest, he was never that interested in helping me. She felt neglected. She felt that her dad would rather spend time helping someone in need than helping her, his own daughter. Why is that? Well, responding to others' needs means that we're therefore needed, you see. And it can be an addictive behaviour. It's actually an addictive behaviour for people in ministry, to be honest. And the problem comes from a deep need in us rather than a deep faith. It comes from what we call a reflected sense of self. We need others' love and approval and gratitude to know who we are and to know why we're doing something. And it's that rather than a heart overflowing with God's love that drives the behaviour. And James is saying, no, there's an order to this, right? Charity begins at home, basically. It's true that it begins in the family, it begins in the church family, and then it flows out into the world. If you see your brother and sister in need, how could you walk past that? So the best way to think of this is that it's an all-of-life thing. And we kind of understand it in those terms, I think. We understand that a loving parent provides practical, compassionate care for their children, don't they? Practical, compassionate care, sacrificial care often for their child. And that's exactly the same as the kindness and the generosity and the compassion that goes in, changes the church and changes the world. Kindness is kindness, whoever it is offered to. Compassion and care are all the same. They all come from the one source, remember. They all come from God. It's God's grace in us, it's Christ in us. So James is talking about an all-of-life thing, and it's achievable by all. See, being caring and being compassionate requires no great skill set. requires no great intellectual understanding. It doesn't even require lots and lots of training. It just requires us to meet people's needs in practical, loving, generous ways. And that's kind of the point of the two examples that James uses. So did you notice the two Old Testament characters that he has in there? It's Abraham and Rahab. Now, they're kind of a contrast because Abraham is the father of the Jews, the father of the faith, really, the patriarch. Years of faith, long years of faith, culminating in an extraordinary moment where he was prepared to sacrifice his son. And James said, there is deeds and faith at work. The contrast to that, in a sense, at the other end of the spectrum is Rahab. So she's not a Jew, she's a Canaanite woman, perhaps a prostitute, who in a moment of hospitality and faith together hides Israelite spies and protects them by sending them off safely. And they're kind of either end of the spectrum here. And they're both, for James, shining examples of deed and faith intertwined. And what that means is we're somewhere in there too. All right? It's possible for all of us. It's possible for all of us. So caring and practical compassion starts in the church and it flows out into the world through our help-filled, love-filled actions. And here's the thing, it's not just organic or spontaneous. When you read this passage, you can kind of think that it's just if you happen to walk past someone who's in need, you should help them. I think it's something deeper than that. It doesn't mean that you can't be organised. So James was a leader in the early church, right? And some of the stories that we know about the early church, we see them getting organised, and that happens in Acts 6. So they were distributing goods to the widows who were in need, and right, this is the religion that James has described as a faultless religion. But it's not happening well, and some people are getting more than they deserve and some people are not getting what they deserve. So the church gets organised and they appoint some people to be responsible for the distribution. And that's okay too. That is practical, compassionate caring. It's okay to be organised, and we shouldn't let organisation and structure obscure what's really at stake, what we're doing. You see, the Red Shield Appeal is a massive feat of organisation. Here, mainly done by Sharon with the help of Barry and others on the team. And there's lots and lots of things to be organised. It can seem that if you're a team leader or whatever, it's, you know, it's organising. But that's okay. Don't let that obscure what's really happening here. One of the things that I noticed on the Red Shield ride, and they talked regularly about the work of the Salvation Army, and they did a great job, was that they never talked about help raising funds for the Salvation Army. They never used that phrase. They never said, your riding today will raise funds for the Salvation Army. They said, your riding today will help a needy and vulnerable person. What you are doing now, that $40 that person gave, that $50, that will feed someone. That $110 that you've raised will house a homeless person and feed them for the night. What you are doing is helping the needy and the vulnerable. Don't let the organisation obscure what's really going on here. And it might seem when we do the streets that we've done for 20 years and there's less and less people home and the donations are smaller and smaller and we used to get $170 and we've only got $43. We're not doing well at raising money for the Salvation Army, but that $43 is actually going to help a needy and vulnerable person. And so we do it. It's a way of changing the world. As Christians, we have an obligation to care for those in need. That was why William had so much passion in his voice. You know, he knew that as the Salvation Army, our job was to change the world. And he literally believed that we would change the world. You know, that was his theology, that the world would be a better place, that the world would one day be healed and redeemed and restored by a boundless salvation. And for James, it's not a political thing, all right? He's not talking here about changing social structures. He's not talking about lobbying members of parliament, whoever your new or unchanged member of parliament may be. It's a heart thing. It's not a call to social justice, but it's actually saying be kind and hospitable and generous to people. It's not a political rallying cry, but a call to personal action. Augustine famously once said, "Love God and do what you will." And the idea behind that is that the true love of God in us, deep faith, leads inevitably to right action. That when our hearts are filled with love, we will behave in loving ways. We'll behave in kind ways. We'll respond with practical compassion. True faith leads to right action, inevitably and assuredly. And here's the thing. James' plea is for true faith, not for more works. We mistake what he's saying here if we think that he is telling us that we need to work harder at being Christians. That is not what he's saying. It's not what he's saying at all. If we lack generosity and compassion and kindness, if they are the symptoms, what he is saying is the solution is deepen your faith. Deepen your faith. I struggle to be kind and generous. Deepen your faith. Deepen your faith. Know God more and more. Allow his love and his grace to be at work in you more and more. It's not about trying to be kinder. I went to a birthday party yesterday. It was a birthday party for a 60-year-old. It's interesting how your life changes. To be honest, when I was a kid, I don't think I had many birthday parties. Well, I think we had a cake with the family or something. I was allowed to choose what Mum cooked, but we didn't have birthday parties much when I was a kid. It's something I've brought up repeatedly with Mum. But your life kind of goes through cycles, right? So you have some 18th birthday parties and you go to 21st and... Back in the day, they used to give you a key. Remember that? Gave you a key and everybody wrote on the key. It was like, do you see? Not ringing a bell. You're a lot younger than me, a lot of you. So you go through this cycle. You know, you go to 18th and you go to 21st and then you go to a 40th or two and you blink twice and you're going to 60th birthday parties. That's kind of the way my life feels at the moment. So I was at this 60th birthday party. And 60th birthday parties are different, right? So this was for a cousin of mine. His name's Dallas Brown. He used to attend Parramatta a long time ago. And so one of Dallas's granddaughters came up to her mum, Dallas's daughter-in-law, and the party had been going for about an hour and a half, and she said, "Mum, when's the party starting?" And her mum said, "It already has started." And she said, she was looking bewildered, and the mum said, "No, there's no games. There's no games." And she said, "What about the presents?" And she said, "I don't think that, you know, Granddad's going to open the presents in front of everybody. You know, the parties are different." And I had been thinking, to be honest, at the party, what I would say if I was called upon to speak. Because I am a preacher and I thought, you know, perhaps 10 or 12 minutes from me would help the party along. And I was wondering what I'd say about Dallas, my cousin. And I'd actually say if I was going to speak to him that he's a good man and he's funny and that he's generous and he's kind. I'd talk about his character. I wouldn't really talk about what he had done. In September this year, our Corps will be 135. Did you know that? That's a great age, isn't it? 135. We're not organising a party, so don't worry. All right, we're not organising a party. I wonder if we did and we each had 10 or 12 minutes to speak, what would we say? What would we say about our core? What would we say about our character? Would we describe ourselves as loving? Would we describe ourselves as practical and compassionate? Would we describe ourselves as a core of deep faith? Of deep faith, life-changing, community-changing faith. Is that what we would say? You'd want to, wouldn't you? You'd want that to be true. I think that should be our goal, shouldn't it? May that always be our goal. Deep, true faith, practical compassion expressed in the people of God, expressed in our core. I want us to sing a song of commitment. And these are words you know well, and the band's going to help us with this tune, the tune of Hendon. It's a song of commitment. It's a song of response. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. And I know that some of you, like me, have seen a few birthdays. All right? We've been on this Christian walk for a while. But I think James' call is always relevant to us. Deepen your faith. Deepen your faith. Know God more and more. Grow in holiness. Grow in love. May we more and more on this journey towards God be Christ-like in who we are. So let's sing this song together. As a prayer, let's sing it as a prayer for ourselves, that God will indeed take our lives as we offer them to him moment by moment, day by day. Thank you, Glenn.